Good day, Montreal. Before we start the show, I want to say a few personal words. This week, I lost a friend. He was a man born half a world away, and a generation older. The kind of man that we built communities and countries on. He came out of the turmoil of the Second World War, losing his father at the age of 7, came here, built a successful business, family, community leader, governor of various organizations, founder of political associations, chairman of a school board, and he died far too young at 67. And he was slowing down in the past few years and wanted to take it easy. And he was entitled to it. But he got caught up in something called Gomery. And though he wasn't named for blame, because his name ended in a vowel, he was part of those who were victimized by the drive-by assassinations of guilt by association and insinuation. He was among the good and gentle and innocent people who are put upon by bad and evil people, sanctimonious suits with facades that make Canadians think black is white and white is black. And this friend got caught up in the middle of that. He wasn't named for any blame, but whatever stress the past year had on him having a fatal heart attack, we as Canadians should be ashamed of the process that led to it. There are people among us with blood on their hands. And those people with blood on their hands who have been in positions of influence in our society for the past 2 years should worry about that blood. Because I believe that from hundreds of places of energy and daring in this country, be they radio stations, community groups, newspapers, Canadians are on the march. Canadians understand that they've been taken for a ride. It's good to remember the words of Pierre Trudeau that in order to realize and vindicate our own capacities as Canadians, we should stop peering suspiciously at each other. And we should concentrate on realizing our great possibilities. The friend that I lost understood how to do that. We have to lose as a country an appetite for gratuitous cannibalism. We've got to become a people, and we need people who give a damn, who live, who take risks, who worry less about whether someone is pure as a driven snow, and more about whether he does things on the ground, not sit in an ivory tower. The words of the American poet Edwin Markham come to mind. We are blind until we see that in the human plan, nothing is worth the making if it does not make the man. And my friends, this week, we lost a man. But he will still be forever with us. And all I can say is, alla prossima, Joe Morselli. Till the next time, till we meet again. We'll be right back. Montreal, we're back. Rick McConomy in studio with me as always. Rick, it's been quite a week. Before we get to discussing what's on our show today, I've been asked to make an announcement, a request actually. You have all read of the anti-Semitic incidents in Côte d'Azur recently, the defacing of four synagogues, and then afterwards the graffiti in Russian that roughly translated as Russia is the last hope of the white race. The police are taking this very seriously, and there is a reward offered of $3,000 for any information. And Sun Youth is as always helpful in this. And please, if anyone has any information, call 842-6822. You can ask directly for Sid Stevens. That's Sun Youth, 842-6822, for any information on the incidents in Côte d'Azur.
And we should say that Sid Stevens and his group at Sun Youth over the years have stepped into the breach in these situations.
Many, many times.
They certainly deserve a lot of credit for taking this on, and hopefully anyone that has any information can call the authorities and move the thing along so we can get some kind of resolution and closure with this thing.
Is this their 50th anniversary at Sun Youth? This year or was it last year?
I think it's this year. I'm not really sure, but I know that Sid, of course,
you've known Sid for a long time. You've been involved with Sun Youth.
He left municipal politics to go and found Sun Youth years ago. We interacted some and sort of in parallel when I was at Centrade. And I know Sid's a big piece of this community, and it's important that the Sun Youth get supported. And it's also important that people know about the work that they do, about the possibility of going there and finding help when anyone's in need.
Throughout the whole year and what the program is.
Exactly, yeah.
We have a good news story that concluding from last week. Last week we spoke to Lisa Priest, a Golden Mail reporter, who was following the case of Raymond Bouchard, who was a man suffering from a very rare type of cancer. And he was offered a drug for free by an American company. Health Canada had not yet approved it. The drug that was approved was $30,000 to $35,000 a treatment cycle, and on OHIP refused to pay for it. So basically, this man was on a death watch.
He was on a death watch. He was going to leave us, and he was shut out by a government that just wouldn't listen and just wouldn't understand.
And last week, the spokesperson for Health Canada said, gee, this is a horrible position for this man to be in. Well, the good news is, and we've said it over and over again on this show, we've talked about advocacy, we've talked about empowerment, we've talked about getting out there and keeping at it. This reporter, Lisa Priest, kept at it, and finally, at the end of this past week, Raymond Bouchard got his medicine, and the excuse from Health Canada was, and I quote, it was a clerical error, and that is why they didn't allow it. Now, Rick, you're a lawyer.
You've been chairman of
Canada United Way. You've done everything in the health and social action area. How does the fact that from last week Health Canada didn't approve something and it still had 6 months to go become a clerical error this week? Who dreams these excuses up?
I don't know whether the death rate in this country is more from heart attack, stroke, car accidents,
or bullshit.
Or clerical error.
How about bullshit?
I mean, the bureaucracy in this country that is so insensitive to the little person's problem of trying to get through the day, trying to get through to a medication that's going to save someone's life, and it takes a campaign in the bloody Globe and Mail pushing. I mean, hats off to Lisa Priest. She deserves a tremendous amount of credit for this. Everyone else has to learn also. Those of you that are sitting with this kind of decision to make, start opening up your mind. You don't have to think out of the box.
And your mouth.
And you don't have to think out of the box. You just have to think, right? And people also, okay, who have this kind of problem, have the faith that if you keep at it, it's going to work out. Just keep hitting on it.
Indeed. And we had examined this problem under the a title of How Health Canada Kills. And we're going today in our first hour and 20 minutes to talk about Canada state failures. It's not all about health care. We'll be talking about our national housing crisis. We'll be talking about how governments have perverted and subverted the use of search warrants, abused our privacy rights. We'll be dealing with the question of the smoking ban. And we'll be dealing on the urgency of tax cuts to relieve the middle class and the working people of this country, and to have government finally realize that they can't just have a blank check from the public treasury to grab votes from any special group they want. So we'll be going into Canada state failures. It's not all about health care. And our issue number one will be public housing and the plight of the poor. And we'll be back right after this. Montreal, welcome back. We're talking about government and why government doesn't do what it should be doing and where its priorities lie. Examining a range of topics today, and we're starting with the question of housing. And we're privileged to be joined by Archbishop Andrew Hutchison, who's the Primate of the Anglican Church of Canada, who wrote a very compelling paper this past week calling on the government to follow the examples of both faith-based communities and community organizations to step in and give all people the human right of that is a prerequisite to health and well-being, and that starts with
a roof over their heads. Archbishop Hutchison, I thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
What brought this to the top five, if you like, of your agenda that you wrote this very compelling piece called "Bring the Homeless into the House," which I would recommend that all people take a look at. It's on the Globe and Mail website.
Mm-hmm. What brought this immediately to the top of the pile is that Cabinet was on the edge of meeting to lock in a budget, which we'll expect to hear from in a speech from the throne very quickly. And there were rumors afoot that a commitment made by the government back in July last year was not going to be fulfilled. I say rumors, but that was enough to bring on some anxiety. In July last year, the Parliament approved a budget that included $1.6 billion over the next 2 years for new affordable housing for Aboriginal and low-income people. And that's the single largest commitment of new housing dollars in more than 10 years. So we wanted to be very sure that government follows through on that commitment, even though there has been a change of government in the interim.
You ended your article with a very compelling quote from Isaiah, which I'll get to later. But in the midst of it, you said the calling is clear. We must all work together to help those of our neighbors who are without house and home, but we must also work to eradicate homelessness and housing deficits in the first place. You just talked about the responsibility of government. Do you have a fear that this commitment, even if the federal government goes through on it, and there's no reason to think they're not, could go the way of the agreement signed in 2001 between the federal government and some of the provinces, where the federal government put up some $200 million each for Ontario, Quebec, less for other provinces, but many provinces did not sign on. Quebec did, Ontario did not. What can be done to make sure that the provinces cooperate with the money that's coming from Ottawa? Because these are joint agreements.
Yes, absolutely they are. My role is a national one, so my voice is always to the federal government. But there are provincial organizations across the country, and I know that our church in Ontario in particular has been in dialogue with the government of Ontario. I'm not sure exactly with what result at this stage, but it's an item on which they are certainly maintaining vigilance, and we'll be pressing the government of Ontario.
You've lived in Montreal, you've lived in Toronto, you're living in Toronto now as the head of the Church in Canada, so you've had experience with both. And as you know, the Quebec government 4 years ago met the $200 million that the federal government put up, so Quebec had $400 million for social and affordable housing. Ontario did not. They simply used the $200 million from the federal government simply funded their $200 million. Are you meeting with the ministers in Ontario directly, with the housing ministers, to assure that in this case this doesn't happen again and that we have the kind of cooperation we need?
I believe that is the case. It's Archbishop Caleb Lawrence, who is the Metropolitan of Ontario, and there is a government liaison department in that synod, and I'm sure they are having direct meetings. But details of it, I'm afraid, are not available to me right now.
Archbishop Hutchison, please stay with us. We'll be back with you right after this. Montreal, we're back talking with Archbishop Andrew Hutchison, Primate of the Anglican Church of Canada, on the urgent need for government involvement in social and affordable housing. Archbishop Hutchison, in the Aboriginal communities, where the need is the greatest, do you see any improvement on the part of the federal government? Because there it's truly a federal government responsibility.
It's very much a federal government responsibility, and there has been some new money flowing in since 1999. But the commitment made last July was a new initiative, and despite the fact that $1.6 billion has been approved, I don't think any of that money has moved. So we are pressing this new government to take advantage of the opportunity to exercise some leadership and step up and release those funds.
You line me up for my next question, and in the interest of full disclosure, I want to tell Montreal that Archbishop Hutchison has been one of the most engaged civic leaders. I won't even call them religious leaders, both in ecumenical work, in demonstrations on behalf of suffering all over the world. So let me ask you, Archbishop Hutchison, is this a time for the faith-based communities to come together with the social action communities, and is there any thought being given to a public action, public responsible agitation to put this issue out in front of the public?
There is not an agenda, but to your first question, absolutely so. And this certainly is a time for leaders of faith-based communities to come together and to call the government to some accountability. I find it interesting that, and I've mentioned this in my article, that Mr. Harper ends many of his addresses by saying, "God bless Canada."
Yes.
We know out of our faith traditions that God blesses you when you share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house.
That's the quote from Isaiah I wanted to remind our listeners of.
Exactly so. So it's that kind of thing that makes this a deep concern for faith-based communities, and since Mr. Harper is tapping into that resource to support his own outlook on Canada, we want to be sure that he measures up to it.
Are you or other denominations or religious leaders reaching out to the social action leaders on public housing, like François Saillant, Frappru in Montreal? Is there any talk?
Absolutely so. Absolutely so. And once again, these are local initiatives. And when I was in Montreal, I would have been directly involved in that kind of thing. But these are local initiatives. Certainly, I can say in Toronto, the Anglican Diocese of Toronto is very deeply involved in housing.
Well, Archbishop Hutchison, as I said before, in full disclosure, I'm a big fan of yours. We've worked together on a lot of things, and if there's anybody in this country that can push a government to do justice, another expression of Isaiah, justice, justice shall you pursue, it's men like yourself, and I thank you for taking the time to be with us on a busy Sunday.
A great pleasure to talk with you, Mr. Wiseman.
Take care.
Right on. Bye-bye.
Montreal will be right back after this with William Thorsell talking about search warrants and the rights of privacy.
We've just been talking about the problems in social and affordable housing with Archbishop Andrew Hutchison. Canada state failures. It's not all about health care. And if any of you out there have problems getting housing, if you have problems with the municipal authorities, we want to hear from you at 790-0006. You can email us at info@iapm.ca. Really major problem when the head of the Anglican Church of Canada, this comes out in the papers, Rick, I mean, major op-ed, and says, hey, this is now a priority. There are people on streets. There's too many.
We keep hearing over and over again that, the casino is not going to go. They're going to do low-cost housing. We don't see any. When I was at the City of Montreal as a leader of the opposition, we talked about Tremblay's engagement and promise to make low-cost housing happen. We're still waiting. The number of low-cost housing units that are supposed to be done in this particular city, way under the performance levels. Let's hear from you out there. Are there people out there that are involved in this issue, that are getting things done, or are we still standing pat the way we were and talking about it, and what we end up with is more condominiums, more middle and upper middle class housing, and the affordable housing that was intended to be financed in all of these projects. Every sucker that goes in front of the governments and
talks about the rights of housing.
The rights of housing. I'm gonna give it to the little people. Well, they give it to us.
With $400 million sitting and unspent.
Unbelievable. Money is sitting there waiting.
Another issue that we're gonna get to now, of course, is another issue of rights being trampled. We hear about our just society. People are still quoting Pierre Trudeau, but certainly not living up to the kind of vigor that he tried to defend the just society with. We see weekly cases of abuse by authority of search warrants, cases of abuse by authority of wiretapping, cases of abuse by authority of privacy rights. This last Liberal government passed a bill before the election that calls on internet service suppliers to keep our email and internet telephony records forever and hand them over on simple state request without probable cause to security authorities, 8,000 files at a time. Our next guest is William Thorsell. Mr. Thorsell, welcome, and thanks for taking the time to be with us on a Sunday.
My pleasure.
William Thorsell has been editor of the Edmonton Journal. He's been with the Globe and Mail. He is currently the CEO and director of the Royal Ontario Museum. And he wrote a very compelling piece this week on the rights of the innocent and how easily they can be trampled. And I presume, Mr. Thorsell, that what prompted you was the Sobrera case in Ontario. And let me just brief listeners in Montreal on this. Greg Sobrera was Ontario's Minister of Finance. The police exercised a search warrant against the company in which he had been involved long before. They knew that by putting his name on the warrant that he'd have to leave cabinet, even though there was no reason for his name to be on the warrant, and they sealed the reasons for why. Was that what prompted you to come out on this issue?
Yes, I mean, it's the latest example of somebody being caught up in an investigation by the police or by the state, where, in my view, there was, not really adequate care and thought taken to the consequences for that person.
Why do you think Canadians don't view our privacy rights in their global sense as important as any other rights that we have? Why are we so laid back?
Well, I think we've, as a country, as opposed to the United States, we're a more deferent society. We show more deference to the state. We look to it to supply us with things. We trust it to be benevolent. And, when you look through just the last 15 years in Canada with the police investigations that have gone wrong and the numbers of people who have actually been jailed for a long time, thank God we don't have capital punishment in this country because there's a lot of dead innocent people. Or, cases where the police have acted, with my view, with carelessness, where people got caught up. Somehow we tend to say, oh, well, that's the price of justice, or that's the price of catching the guilty, or whatever. I think the price is much too high, and yet we should be demanding more.
And yet it really is not. And we're just 24 years from the implementation of the charter. From a prime minister who agree or disagree with everything Trudeau did, tried to make the individual sovereign over the state. Privacy was important. Even in the debates on revising the wiretap law back in 1979, there was the famous exchange when Ramsey Clark, the former American Attorney General, came to speak to the Justice Committee of the House. And Claude Vagnin, at that time, an MP from Quebec, said to Mr. Clark, well, we need these onerous wiretap powers because the underworld uses bugging. And Mr. Clark responded, well, the underworld also uses murder, but I don't think that's an appropriate tool for government.
That's right.
Where have we...
I must say you referred to the Charter of Rights, and it is only 23 years old, but we're starting to learn to use it a little bit more aggressively. A column I wrote in the Globe and Mail last week, I pointed out that I happen to be one of the first people through the Edmonton Journal to use the Charter of Rights. Because 2 days after it was proclaimed on the 17th of April, 1982, the Combines Investigation Department raided the Edmonton Journal's publisher, looking for incriminating evidence that we were being unfair.
You were associate editor.
I was associate editor, being fair against the Edmonton Sun. And he called me in, and they were going through his office, packing up the boxes, and I said something very simple, and he did too. Where's the search warrant? And they said...
Reasonable question, isn't it?
Yeah, where's the search warrant? Under the Combines Investigation Act, they didn't need a search warrant. They were one of the government agencies that could just come in and take all your files, go through them, and then lay charges.
Exactly.
Without ever getting a search warrant. And we said to them, well, there's something called the Charter of Rights. It's 2 days old, and it has protection against unreasonable search and seizure, and you need a search warrant. So we went right downtown to the judge. He sealed the boxes. The government, of course, didn't believe this. We took them to court, and we won. So now the Combines people have to go and get a search warrant as well.
Well, that was the beauty of the Charter. It went across all of the legislation and brought it all under the Charter, and then you had to make a specific exception for it.
That's right. And, I think that people – but, of course, the Charter has to be used, and often it's not the government that attacks itself using the Charter. Right. It's usually – a company, an individual, a group that says, some law of the government is FAR and this protection in the charter.
There's also an attitudinal thing, which we'll get back to as soon as we take a short break.
Bill, stay with us.
Yeah.
Monsieur, we're back. We're talking with William Thorsell, CEO of the Royal Ontario Museum, about privacy rights, the abuse of search warrants, the abuse of press freedoms.
We're talking about attitudes, William. Bill, you know, does every investigation have to have like a PR officer on it where they start leaking this stuff out, putting it out in the public and crucifying people before they even get into the investigation? Is this part of the problem?
Well, here I think you put your finger on a very strange thing where the media are often, implicated. Sometimes the police, if they're exercising a search warrant, particularly if they're doing drugs, a drug raid or a biker raid or something popular like that, they will bring the media along. I mean, they will actually tip them off, organize them, help them come and cover it. You'll see it live on almost live television. You know, 20 minutes ago this happened, and we were there, and we saw the exercise of a search warrant. Now, the exercise of a search warrant doesn't mean someone's guilty.
Not at all.
It means that the police have been able to make a case to a judge that they have reasonable cause and probable cause to look for evidence.
But that's a problem here in Canada, Bill. I mean, it's like we live in a country, the new two solitudes. There are the people who understand the laws and their rights, and there's the vast majority who let government dictate to them how they live. They let government protect themselves from themselves, and they think it's normal. You could have the most illiterate, inbred hillbilly on the border of Kentucky and Tennessee. If he sees somebody coming from the government, he says, "You get the hell off my land. I got the Bill of Rights." He can't read the Bill of Rights, but it's in his blood. It's taken 23 years, and we still don't understand that we have a right to run our own lives?
Well, we've got a couple of hundred years of so-called peace, order, and good government in us.
Which is all we promise, as opposed to life and liberty.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is a deep DNA in the Canadian psyche.
Exactly.
I'm stealing that phrase, deep DNA, by the way. It's going to show up in our next papers.
And we're legislating conduct, right? We're legislating how people live and what they do and the choices that they make.
Yeah, and we're raised to think that if everything is orderly and all the rest of it, everything must be good. Just don't bother me. And this is where we have a lot to learn from our American cousins, because although it goes too far sometimes there, it doesn't go far enough here. And these tools that are coming, charters of rights, privacy commissioners, rights of information, these tools have been created in Canada, but we're not using them very much. And it'll take probably a generation and further maybe provocations before we finally start saying, just a minute, I'm not going to assume off the top that because the state is acting, it's okay.
Because it's legislation, it doesn't mean it's right.
That's right. Or because it's a civil servant or a police officer or a prosecutor, doesn't mean off the top that it's okay. Sometimes, they make mistakes. Sometimes they don't do their homework. Sometimes they're just in a bad mood, I suppose. But
William Thorsell, you put it very well. Does the state exercise its power responsibly? And to quote William Thorsell, transparency suggests they must. They can't afford to be that wrong that often when it comes to such great injustices. And unfortunately, Montreal and everybody listening on the web, we see the state failing spectacularly and often. William Thorsell, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Bill.
All the best.
Rick, you've represented a lot of companies where you've seen this kind of stuff happen. Now we're getting the state into things in Ontario. You can't ride a bicycle without a helmet. And it's
amazing.
The frustration level is... Yeah. Is it only us?
They
is
call it normative law. Law that tells you how to act, how to live. We have a...
Are we the last angry people left?
No, we have an issue with this morning. This afternoon, I'm sure that we get into exactly that, the forcing of people to act in a given way when freedom would mean they should have a choice.
We've just been joined in studio by Peter Sergakis, who's president of the Union of Bar Owners of Quebec, and Vula Demopoulos, who's vice president. They are launching, they have launched a challenge to Bill 112, which is the anti-smoking ban. They perfectly well understand that if people are offended by cigarette smoke or don't like it or can't stand it, that's all well and good, but give smokers the right to congregate where they want. It's a freedom of assembly issue. And Julius Gray, probably Canada's leading civil liberties attorney, is challenging this law. And right after this break, we will be back with Peter Sergakis, Vula Demopoulos, and Julius Gray to discuss how the state is trying to tell us what to do with our leisure time now. We'll be right back after this. Montreal, we're back. Rick McConaughey's in the studio with me. We're talking about Canada's state failures. It's more than about health care. And we're talking about the lack of social housing after all the fake promises from governments. We've been talking about the trampling of privacy rights through search warrants and wiretapping, improperly implemented and illegally instituted. Our next issue underlines the pettiness of government, that governments fail to address the political and distributive issues that plague us all and decide to replace them with things that they think are good for us. And we could call this next segment State Smoke Gets in Our Eyes. In studio with us is Peter Srigakis, the president of the Union of Bar Owners of Quebec, and Vula Dimopoulos, the vice president. Welcome, Peter. Welcome, Vula. They have launched a legal challenge to Bill 112, which seeks to disallow smoking anywhere, any private club, any private reunion, any wedding, any terrace outside. You can't smoke within 30 meters of an entrance of a building. This is the critical issue for Quebec. In a society where two-thirds of our working men and women have 2 weeks of salary or less in the bank, this is the critical issue for Quebec. Their lawyer is leading civil liberties attorney Julius Gray, who joins on the phone. Julius, welcome again.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Julius, the basis for your challenge to Bill 112, before we talk to Peter and Vula on the details of how this is going to hurt business.
Well, it is not the validity of regulation in this field. There is no doubt that the government can have public health regulations. It's the details of this law. It's the excess. Remember, it's not a new law. There's been a law so far. It's not challenged. It has reduced smoking. But now they go into the type of law that clearly raises charter issues. And they tell you you can't smoke in your own office. When they tell you you cannot smoke at all if you're in, you can't even have a well-ventilated and separated smoking area in a restaurant or a bar. When they go into such issues as terraces and just general petty regulation, when they ignore Supreme Court and Court of Appeal jurisprudence about freedom of speech and say you can't advertise anything, at a certain point you have to ask yourself, what's the point? There is already a law, no evidence that it's working badly.
So what's the driver of all this? Has Couillard got nothing else to do?
The Quebec government has been such a miserable failure in everything. They've got to have something to show the public that they've done, whether it's right or wrong. And, of course, one of the things about it is that the effects of this law, whether it in fact helps anybody, gets anybody off cigarettes, whether there's any effect on the health side, will not be known for 20 years.
Well, I'm glad you said miserable failure of this government, because whenever I say it, Rick says I'm understating the case.
Well, I think I'm understating
right,
it, too.
Absolutely.
I have some very colorful words to use for all the series of mistakes. But it seems to me that the only purpose is political. And people, there is such a hysteria about smoking that people don't understand that there is already a law, that this law appears to be working, that the new law just adds a bunch of petty and small-minded invasions of privacy and very little else.
It's showmanship instead of being willing to face the problem and try and solve it, as you say, with properly ventilated areas, with isolation.
Properly ventilated areas, isolation, so on. But there's another problem, of course. The other problem is that there's very solid scientific evidence that smoking is not good for you. That evidence has been around since the 50s, really. But the evidence is secondhand.
Well, nothing in excess is good for you.
Well, that's right. But smoking in particular is not good for you if you're addicted or you take a pack or two a day. But the evidence in secondhand smoke is particularly weak. But it's a secondhand smoke that is the justification. What they tell you is, well, alcohol doesn't affect other people, only smoking does. That's nonsense.
Well, we're going to be right back to discuss this with Peter and Vula and the phrasing of their objections to this right after this. Montreal, welcome back. Email at info@iepm.ca. And we're talking about state smoke getting in your eyes and how much state intrusion into our lives we can take. And with us in studio is Peter Srigakis and Vula Dimopoulos, president and vice president, respectively, the Union of Bar Owners of Quebec, who have launched a legal challenge to Bill 112. Their lawyer is civil liberties attorney Julius Gray, is on the line with us. And what is interesting is the way, Peter and Vula, you have phrased your opposition to it, not as a matter of finance, but as a matter of freedom of choice. Could you speak to that, Peter?
Well, it's everything included. I mean, sometimes we're talking one thing and sometimes we're talking of both things. But basically what we want to have freedom of choice, and we're saying, too, that we are private enterprises, And we want to be able to do whatever we want in our establishments. And if we want our establishment to be smoking, and then it's going to be smoking. And if we want our establishment to be both, could be both. And if we want our establishment to be no smoking, and then we leave the thing naturally change. As you know, right now in the restaurants in Quebec, 40% of them are no smoking, and they have done it naturally. The consumer dictates to them what they want. And
so the public should choose.
That's right. I mean,
So, Vula, the position is a simple one. People have a right to assemble. We're adults.
Mm-hmm.
Tobacco is legal. And you understand that some people, forget about the health issue, which we'll get back to in a moment, they don't like the smell of cigarette smoke. Some people don't like the smell of perfume. But you have a right to have a non-smoking establishment and a smoking establishment, just like you have to have a right today to attack a smoking cabinet and a non-smoking cabinet.
That's right.
That's all you're asking.
We're just providing a product and a service to our clientele that is legal. And why should we not, like everything else that's out there?
You've run into a lot of provincial bureaucrats, and when you talk to them about let us act like adults, what do they tell you? Treat us like adults. What do they tell you?
They tell us that smoking isn't good for us. It's it's detrimental to our health. So are so many other things out there.
Yeah, but what basically we're saying, we understand that smoking is not good for you, but it's up to us. It's up to us humans to decide what we want in our lives to do. You know,
as Julius Gray, you were mentioning the secondhand smoke issue being a red herring. You know, we know that in secondhand smoke, there are 1.5 carcinogens per parts per thousand. In spring water, there's 1.9.
Yeah.
We know that if you drink a bottle of whiskey a day, you're going to kill yourself. So the public health issue is the fact that smoke is naturally intrusive. Whiskey only goes down your gullet. What problem does the government have with letting smokers congregate where they want?
Well, it's that particular type of paternalism. It's when a campaign forms. You remember in the early part of the 20th century, the campaign was against drinking.
Right.
And the Americans then passed prohibition. They made the fortunes of the mafia, and the thing didn't work. And in the end, it turned out that even the statistics, you know, statistics in every epoch seem to reflect social values of the epoch, so that in epochs when, for instance, people think homosexuality is a dreadful thing, there's all sorts of evidence how bad it is, when in fact it's all false. In this particular case, there is some evidence about smoking. That evidence is quite objective. But about the secondhand smoke, I don't understand why people don't have rules about exhaust fumes, which smell bad and are worse for you, probably.
And this is a slippery slope we're going down. I mean, by the same logic, if a government says, we're not going to let you smoke because it's bad for you, does the government then say, well, you can't ski because, for example, the health costs of treating broken legs, even though smokers pay more taxes and die younger?
We have that problem with the Kirpan.
Sorry, Peter.
Yeah. No, but what we've been saying is, if the product it's so bad for your health, we're asking the government to declare it legal and then stops collecting $1 billion a year, and that's what they're making right now from.
There's a basic fundamental conflict of interest. The amount of taxes that's raised off of smokers.
$1 billion in Quebec a year. That's where we're collecting. And on the other hand, they're claiming it's so bad for you. It's so bad for you. Well, declare it illegal, and then we solve the problem. Nobody's going to have a problem anymore.
But it's not worth their while. It's not worth their while because by legalizing it, they're still collecting taxpayers' money from that end, and they're going to start collecting more money by fining bar owners, and they're going to collect even more money when they start fining people who are going to be doing contraband.
And more importantly, Montreal, wake up to this. Yeah. Government is big business. Every time they declare something illegal, they hire thousands of new bureaucrats.
Right.
They perpetuate themselves by sticking their nose into our lives more and more, in addition to the fines, as Vula Demopoulos just said. So it enriches them financially, and it enriches them in terms of their power. In private business, you judge your success by the bottom line. Government judges their success by how many people they got out there, an army. We in Quebec have three times the number of bureaucrats as the state of California. for 20% of the population.
What is going to happen by...
Sorry, Julius, yes?
Okay.
Julius.
Sorry,
all
Julius.
I wanted to say is that they're apparently planning a snitch line as well. And that is
of course, we have to have a rat society.
A very disturbing development in all of our society, the number of snitch lines and the encouragement to snitch, and snitching is honorable now.
What infuriates me is that Canadians, you know, I was born in Russia, you were born in Eastern Europe as well, and I remember the little old lady at the end of the hall of way in every apartment taking down the names of people who were leaving and coming on your floor. And then she would report that to the government. And our Quebecers, who have a history of fighting passionately for freedom in their lives, are they so blind to this? Is no one going to stand up?
Silence, silence, silence.
Well, Peter wanted to say something, I think.
Well, what I want to say is after the 31st of May, when the law comes to the effect, people are going to take the booze or beer at home, and they're going to smoke and have parties in the houses where they're going to be kids, minor kids, 3, 4, 5, 6
years. Or there's going to be speakeasies and blind pigs, and we'll be back right after this with Marianne, who wants to give her opinion on this subject. Montreal, we're back. We're talking about getting the state out of our lives and stopping them from treating us like children. In studio with us, Rick McConomy with me, and Peter Sergakis and Vula Dimopoulos, President and Vice President of the Union of Bar Owners of Quebec, who are fighting Bill 112, the anti-smoking law. On the line with us, Julius Gray, Canada's leading civil liberties attorney, and Marianne is calling in. Marianne, how are you? Where are you calling from?
Hello.
Marianne?
Yes, Maria.
How are you? Where are you calling from?
From Montreal.
What do you think of all this?
Me, I'm thinking that if you're not allowed to smoke in any place, then we just respect the law, but when we buy cigarette, we should. The government not collect any tax. Should be collect any tax.
Well, you know, 80% of the cost of a pack of cigarettes goes right to the government.
Exactly.
So how do you do that?
Yeah, but it's not supposed to be like that, because if we are not allowed to smoke in any place to respect the smoker, why he collect the tax when we buy cigarette?
Well, we can't do anything about the tax, but how far are you prepared to go? How far is everybody prepared to go? Peter and Vula, Julius, how far should we go in civil disobedience?
I don't know. I think it's very wrong, you know. I mean, come on.
Are you ready to light up a cigarette in a public place?
Me? Well, I like to smoke, but...
Would you go to jail? Would you go to jail because you smoke?
Oh, please, no way. No,
so I don't smoke.
So you wouldn't defy the law?
No,
I don't.
Well, I don't know, Peter. I mean, let's say they pass this idiotic kindergarten nanny state law. Why can't we get together 200-300 people somewhere and have a smoking party right at downtown Montreal and let the police come and give us fines and refuse to pay the fines?
I don't mind doing it, but I don't think Mr. Gray doesn't have the same opinion as you.
No,
right?
I don't think this is bad.
Marianne, hang on 1 second. Julius,
I
yes?
This is a case for civil disobedience. This is a case for contesting and then seeing what's legal and what's not. There are many more cases. There are situations, I think, in life. I refuse to say that civil disobedience is always wrong, but I think we have to be very sparing with it, because it has to be used only where there is no other way. And in this particular case, there's research. There are ways of getting around it. For instance, perhaps it may well be that in the end there will be solutions found with fumoir off the premises. It's not good. They're not good solutions. They're not satisfactory ones.
But you're not going to get judgments on that. You know, you and I both know that. What you have to do is get out there and make some kind of a protest.
No, what you have to do is you have to convince the population that some of the that some parts of this law are fine and some other parts are idiotic beyond belief. And once people believe and they start to laugh, those parts that are good.
But Julius, you know that, you know, this is like taxes. You know, anytime a government puts on a tax, it never cuts the tax. Once they start legislating this, then obesity's next, sports are next. You remember the famous quote from Gandhi, we are a society of laws and not of men, but when bad men make bad laws...
Look, we live in a society that works on crazy campaigns. Obesity certainly is one of the... You know, being thin is one of the obsessions of our times. Obsessive in a way where, for instance, we've completely lost the aesthetic of, say, Rubens and Renoir.
Thank you.
There are all sorts of other sort of campaigns, and at the same time, they're destroying the public sector. The zoo is closing, the opera is falling apart, the hospitals can't be built.
In other words, everybody's going back to government and touching the shit.
Well, we're spending our time on issues that are not important and that are being built up as sort of histrionic objects of I don't know, derision, hate.
Julius, I tell you something. You know, as much as I love you, I've already done a deal with McConomy here because I want to follow Gandhi here. You know, we are a society of laws and not of men, but when bad men make bad laws and unprincipled officials compromise good ones, it's time to stand up and be a man and exercise responsible agitation to stop governments from staggering drunkenly from wrong to wrong merely to perpetuate their own immortality. I love that line.
Look,
I just want to know if you're allowed to smoke in jail.
I think the church is perfectly correct in giving asylum to people who have been unjustly deprived of asylum. I think if our government were to try to take us to war, there would be a good enough reason for refusing to comply. But when it comes to this, there are many, many bad laws. And we have to, civil disobedience, while not excluded, and I think only it's one of the worst things to say that the law must always be obeyed, nevertheless, it is to be extremely rare. It is only effective if it is extremely rare, and society can only function if it is extremely rare.
Julius, thanks very much. Peter Sardakis, the last word goes to you. Where do we go from here?
Well, we're going to continue fighting, and I tell you, in June, there are going to be a lot of people unhappy if the law goes in effect. So everybody's going to get on board. As you know, we created the Union de Tennessee de Bas du Québec. It was created by me and Vula, and we're going to fight to the end, and we're going to try to protect the bar owners' rights.
Thank you, Peter Sergakis. Thank you, Vula Demopoulos. Thank you, Julius Gray. And Montreal, if you're as mad as hell and you want to join the last angry men, Rick, where do they call?
The Union of Bar Owners of Quebec, 937-0531. Join up, 937-0531, and make the fight the good fight, and fighting the good fight something we do together.
And show Quebec you're mad as hell and you're not going to take it anymore. We'll be right back after this. Montreal, we're back. Rick McConney in the studio with me, and we're talking about what government fails at. They get their noses into stuff that's none of their business, like anti-smoking laws. They don't produce enough social and affordable housing. They don't enforce laws that respect our privacy. And we're paying for all of that with ever-increasing tax cuts. Increases in tax, I'm sorry, Rick, you're right. Scoring short-term political points at the expense of long-term economic gain is bad economics and bad politics. And the author of those fighting words is with us here online, Tasha Kearden, Executive Vice President of the Montreal Economic Institute. Tasha, thank you very much for being patient as we're running a little late with the show.
Busy day today, Beryl. No problem. Thanks.
We've just gone out through all these issues of what the government doesn't do. People are put upon by laws, but people are also put upon by spectacularly high taxes paying for statocratic nanny state stuff. What this government in Quebec was elected on the basis of tax reform. So are other governments that you mentioned in a very compelling piece you wrote in the National Post this week. What's going on?
Well, it is you got to wonder what's going on when you see the three governments who handed down budgets last week, all of them abandoning the idea of tax cuts. Mr. Charest promised $1 billion in tax relief per year. And, I mean, the studies done at the Institute and studies done by other groups as well have shown that tax cuts actually stimulate more economic growth in the long term than simply doing what they're doing, like paying down debt or increasing government spending. And it's disheartening to see that all three governments are abandoning that. We feel that, especially in Quebec, where you pay the highest marginal tax rates in all of Canada, there's a lot of room for improvement.
Are we getting anything for our money? Or is this just nanny state control stuff that they're passing?
Well, the government seems to want to get its hands into more and more types of areas, and that's also disturbing. I mean, we at the Institute published an article on the SAQ earlier this year, which got a lot of play. That's a perfect example of where government shouldn't be intervening in the economy. Alberta privatized its liquor sales, and the government still collects taxes on booze, but people have a lot more choice. They have cheaper products on the shelves. This is the kind of thing that we shouldn't be spending government money doing. The private sector has to play a greater role in the economy.
Tasha, can you talk about taxation without representation? The case of the 5% increase or almost 5% increase by Hydro-Québec this year, 10% next year, and it's not coming through cabinet or it's being debated at the National Assembly?
Well, that again, it's interesting to see that Premier Charest is taking this tactic of the Generations Fund to pay down our debt. That's his proposal, as opposed to cutting taxes and letting an increase in revenue happen and use that money to pay down the debt. And that's directly related to Hydro-Québec. He's telling us there won't be a rate increase, but that's not true. There actually is a rate increase coming. And he's claiming that the money that they're going to try and save at Hydro-Québec, that's going to be put into this Generations Fund. It's basically a shell game, moving one expense to another, and it's hidden taxation. And quite honestly, it shouldn't be happening. The government should trim its expenses instead, cut taxes to increase economic growth, and then it would collect more revenue.
And also get out of areas where they shouldn't be in our personal lives, which I know is another... is another part of the work that the Montreal Economic Institute does.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's so much regulation in Quebec. The average small or medium-sized business spends 15% of its time and resources just complying with
filling
regulation.
Forms. Tasha, if you could just stay with us. We're just going to pay some bills, and we'll be right back with you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Welcome back, Montreal. We're talking about tax cuts and the necessity of them with Tasha Kieran, Executive Vice President of the Montreal Economic Institute. Tasha, if there were three things that you could tell a government to stop doing, just get rid of them and give the money back to the people, what would they be?
Well, I think one of the first areas would be to, and this is not necessarily just stop doing, but allow other people to do. It's very important in the area of health care, is stop simply spending more money on health care and allow the private sector to have a greater role in the delivery of health care, take the pressure off the public system. The second thing would be to privatize certain things like the SAQ, which don't make economic sense. You know, people are there's a huge outcry about the zoo in Quebec City now, that the government is letting the zoo go. Well, the government should be the zoo business. It shouldn't be in the liquor business in the first place. There's certain things the government shouldn't do. So that would be the second thing. And the third thing that they should stop doing would be basically stop taxing us so much. I mean, you look at the highest marginal tax rate in the country is in Quebec. I mean, we pay 20% here. Once you hit $56,000 a year in income, go to Ontario, you're paying 17% once you hit $76,000 in income. The definition of rich in Quebec is completely confusing. I mean, middle-class people are being squeezed to here with the highest tax rate, and it's not fair. So I would say stop taxing us at that rate. Increase the basic, increase the level at which you hit the highest tax rate to what it should be, what's in other provinces.
And of course, it's also a top-down process. I mean, at the federal level, we've got $160 billion federal budget. We've got this $20 billion multicultural slash touchy-feely program complex that we really don't need, that you know, the politicians just give out as checks for votes. How do we roll that back and give that money back as tax rollbacks to the Canadian people?
I think the federal government started to wake up to the fact that a lot of money spent, like the Council for Canadian Unity, for example, is not going to be funded anymore. You know, some people will say, well, the government should be promoting federalism, but let's face it. I mean, the government doesn't exist to fund groups that don't. You can't demonstrably show that they had an impact without which we wouldn't have won the referendum the last time, for example, on the
that great phrase, I mean, value for money. Where do we have value for money and anything else?
Exactly. You're spending money on these things, and what are you getting out of it? And we got a huge sponsorship scandal out of a lot of what the government was doing allegedly to combat separatism in Quebec. So you have to really look and say, well, you know, from an economic standpoint, what business should the government be in? And I don't think that is one of the areas. And like you said, it's done a lot of the times to score political points or get votes, give favors to friends. In the case of the sponsorship scandal, we've had enough of that. Let's get the government back to its core business.
And let's evaluate the government on its performance, on
exactly
what it delivers and what it manages to give as relief.
Yeah, and have an economic attitude towards these issues as opposed to simply a political attitude and rewarding your friends.
Tasha, I thank you very much for being with us. I know your time is tight. You're in the process of moving from Toronto to Montreal.
That's
I congratulate
right.
you on taking this new position at the MEI. It's Montreal's gain. And I know you can't say this, but I can. Montreal, Canada, you know what? She makes sense. Maybe it's time for a bit of a tax revolt. Tasha Kieran, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tasha.
Bye.
Andy's on the line. Andy? Andy's not on the line.
Well, Andy's with us again, is he? Andy, we're concerned about what you have to say to us this week.
Okay, I'll tell you what it is. Okay, I agree that maybe the SAQ should be privatized, given
right.
to organizations like people, foundations. Like,
what about health care?
The healthcare should never be privatized, because you're going back to the ages where my grandfather was back in Hungary, where he had to mortgage his home to be able to be operated.
Is there not possible to run a mixed system where you're doing the public and the private?
You know what the people are crying about? Because they're not the ones who are stealing and someone else is stealing.
Okay, but it's not just about health care. How do you feel about all the issues we've talked about where the state is sticking their nose in your business? They're coming into your house with search warrants. They're telling us how to smoke, how to act, what to eat. You came from Hungary. I came from Russia. We left to be free.
Yes, I love to be free, but there's one thing. Smoke, if you can't stay not smoking for a few hours, you don't have the right to kill me with the secondhand smoke.
You don't have a right to tell me that I can't go somewhere and smoke?
No.
Why should you have that right?
Just a minute. You can do anything you want, but there's one
Andy,
thing.
You can't, because the new law says you can't even congregate with smokers to smoke anywhere.
No, there's one thing. If I don't smoke... If I want to go to a club, I cannot go anywhere because it stinks. Now, the thing is this.
No, the opposite is happening. If you do smoke, you cannot smoke anywhere because you're not allowed in because you're going to be smoking.
One thing, Mr. Wiseman. When I don't smoke, but
barrels
I don't
enough. No, Mr. Wiseman.
But it's if I don't smoke, I don't affect.
Okay, Andy, we're tight for time, but you've got to understand this law. This law doesn't give anybody a choice. It says no smoking anywhere, even if you're making a party at a hall that you rent. It says you can't even have a restaurant only for smokers. So that's
what?
It's proto-Stalinist. Andy, thanks for your time. We talk a lot, Rick, about how people should get out there, be heard, get empowered, get enfranchised, and we usually talk about it in the national, municipal, or provincial levels. Well, we have with us Bert Rafel from Toronto, a lawyer, Rafel Partners, and Bert has been involved in so many progressive causes over the years, from civil rights to tort claims to
giving
protecting.
Time to bar associations.
It's just too long to go into, but he's involved in a fascinating lecture that's going to be coming up in Toronto, where he's hosting a law firm called Motley Rice from South Carolina that is suing. They've taken advocacy to an international level. They're suing Hamas under something called the Alien Tort Claims Act. And Bert, welcome to the show.
How do you do?
It's a pleasure to have you here. I'm going to ask you to stand by because I'm getting a signal that we got to pay a bill, and we'll be right back with you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bert.
This is interesting.
Montreal, we're back. And we've been talking today, and as we usually do through all our shows, about empowerment and what citizens should do and how they should rage against their governments here. Well, we're talking with Bert Rafel, senior partner, Rafel Partners in Toronto, about a new kind of rage that's taken to the international level. A firm in South Carolina called Motley Rice is using something called the Aliens Tort Act, the Aliens Tort Claims Act, to sue Hamas terrorists for damage done to their victims. And Bert is hosting them in Toronto at a conference that's upcoming. And Bert, could you tell us something about this?
Well, basically, he's coming to educate us Canadian lawyers as to what we can do to emulate the sort of things he's been doing. Our difficulty will be that there's no such legislation that he's operating under in the United States.
So what are they trying to do? They're using an American act, the Alien Tort Claims Act.
Yes, to act on behalf of victims of terrorism. And what they're trying to do is to sue rogue states like Iraq and Syria and the Palestinian Authority.
And where would the suits take place?
What they do is, if one of the victims is, say, an American, they sue in the United States. If the victim is from France, then they sue in France. But the best avenue is, you know, where the victim comes from, so the courts will have proper jurisdiction.
So Israel, would they be suing in Israel?
There are some claims in Israel, and curiously enough, they've had some resistance. Other people have tried it in Israel. The Israeli court is afraid that if they alienate these other states, that it'll impact on the peace process.
Well, leaving Israel aside, though, we have in a case of a young man named Jason Friedberg, who unfortunately was killed, he's in Montreal, he was killed in Israel.
Yes.
If Canada had similar legislation, Hamas could be sued in Montreal.
Well, exactly. And what we want to have here in Canada is enabling legislation. For example, in the States, the difficulty they ran into, they've actually tried to freeze assets of these other countries, but the fear is that they run into the sanctity of diplomatic immunity. So what they're trying to do to circumvent that is they are suing the fake charity organizations. They're suing banks that pay off suicide bombers so they can get around, you know, the protection that governments have.
And because those people are in the private sector, they're open and exposed.
They're not protected as government. But you see, the difficulty I foresee here, and I'll try not to be a little political, but
be political. We don't do political correctness here.
All right. For years, my organization railed against the Liberal government under Pierre Trudeau and others for not prosecuting Nazi war criminals. It took the Tories to bring in the enabling legislation with the Duchenne Commission so that now, not many, but some Nazis have been prosecuted. We're hoping now that a conservative government in Canada will listen to us and pass enabling legislation so that we can sue terrorist organizations here in Canada and obtain not only compensation for the victims or the families of victims, but to block the money that these agencies flow to terrorists.
And was that was used against the Shah of Iran at one point in time? There was Noriega and other people like that that the Americans went after?
Yes, yes.
But same legislation.
We need the legislation here, and that's why we're looking forward to Motley giving us some advice on how we can do that here in Canada.
Bert, among all your other work that you've done over the years in civil rights, you're chairman of Canadian Lawyers and Jurists for Rural Jury. But this kind of a law is not just about terrorists on Israel or terrorists against Jews. It sends a message to all terrorists that, hey, we can take your stuff anywhere you are. There's multiple battlefields, so while the soldiers are over in the Middle East keeping the fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, they're going to have a lot of problems with their money here.
And once we cut off their money, we cut off their flow of weapons.
Exactly. Once you get to the sympathizers, you're getting to the real bread and butter issues. Exactly.
Has there been any draft laws put up by any organization be submitted to Ottawa?
To my knowledge, the only action has come from lawyers in Israel and lawyers in the United States. And one of my undertakings will be, once we speak to Ron Motley, is to approach our federal government for enabling legislation so we can do the same thing here.
So the leadership is going to be taken in this country, and following this presentation, the leadership is going to press to get something similar to the Alien Tort Claims Act here.
And what we hope to do is to get behind, you know, some of these phony charities that, under the guise of being benevolent, are really helping fund terrorists in the Middle East.
Well, this is truly a project that's a civil rights issue, and one of the past honorary chairmen of Canadian Lawyers and Jurists for World Jury was the Honorable Emmett Hall,
indeed,
who, as much as anyone, was one of the most progressive justices of Canada's ever produced.
A remarkable man.
And a remarkable man. And
Bert, you're fighting the good fight. Keep it up.
And this is really taking advocacy not just to the municipal, provincial, and federal level, but it shows that we as Canadians and the wealth of talent we have with people like you, Bert, and the tradition of people like Justice Hall, how we can really affect the world scene. And, Bert, I thank you very much for joining us on a busy weekend.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
Bert,
thank
a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
And Montreal, that's it for this week. We'll see you next week. I want to thank Chris Smith, our operator, Val Pertinkoff, our producer. Rick, great show. And Montrealers, you can take back your lives. So go out there and start screaming. See you next time.